I'm very happy now to introduce Gary Paul Nabhan. He is Kellogg Endowed Chair for Sustainable Food Systems at the Southwest Center at the University of Arizona. He's the author of many books. His latest is Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers in Adapting to Climate Uncertainty. He will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be with you, Mary Charlotte.
So there are so many ways that climate change and drought are affecting farmers and food production all over the world. What are some of the manifestations that are happening that you are seeing?
Well, this uncertainty is the thing that farmers are reeling from, that we may have severe freezes like the ones we've had the last 3 years in southern Arizona and southern New Mexico that knock back our crops into winter, and then we may have drought or heat waves, as most of the West has had. But we also have water scarcity, and that's a major issue for all of the New Mexico farmers, particularly those south of Elephant Butte's reservoir that are getting only 3 acre inches instead of 4 acre feet for their irrigation needs. So there are many, many different manifestations of climate uncertainty, not just global warming.
Many of us think of climate change as being caused by cars and cities and factories, but I think a really important thing to talk about is that the food system itself is a big part of the engine of climate change. Tell us about that. What does that look like?
Well, let's begin with the fact that it's the food system as a whole, not just what happens on a farm, that
right.
creates such carbon emissions. Only a fifth of the carbon emissions associated with the food we eat, what I call our carbon food print, are on-farm carbon emissions from tractors, from pumping water, from deeper and deeper wells, from using nitrogen fertilizers that are fossil fuel-based. So all of those embedded carbon costs that are in each spoonful of food we eat come from both what happens on-farm and what happens after it leaves the farm gate and goes through 8 hands before it reaches us 1,200 to 1,500 miles away from where most of that food began.
You wrote a recent piece in the New York Times that farmers need to start implementing strategies to deal with the new hotter and drier reality. That's the title of your book. What are some of those strategies?
Well, the great thing is that our best farmers have already been innovating on this, and desert farmers, such as those in the arid Southwest, have been adapting crop varieties, irrigation methods, and the timing of their plantings to reduce drought and heat loads for a long time. So we can learn from all this innovation that farmers and ranchers are doing, not only in our own region, but in other arid areas around the world. Particularly increasing soil moisture holding capacity by augmenting our soils with composted materials that increase that water holding capacity can buffer us from both heat and from drought. We can also do multi-layered plantings of fruit trees and even taller trees over some of our row crops, or solar panels over our vegetable row crops to reduce the heat load on them, and most of those crops will still have equal or higher yields if their heat loads and heat stress are reduced by canopies above them.
It's interesting because the things that you're talking about, strategies like compost, is kind of labor-intensive. Having fruit trees and things shade your crops makes perhaps mechanistic agriculture a little bit more difficult. So it sounds and it feels like you're talking about things that are moving toward a more human labor, at least to some extent, kind of agriculture.
That's true in some cases, and most community-supported agriculture projects do hand-apply compost or have rows of maybe 3 or 4 field crops between rows of fruit trees. But this can also be done on medium and large scale. So in France, they're putting 15 to 20 foot high solar collectors above row crops, and tractors can still get in between the solar collectors. Urban areas such as San Francisco and associated Marin and Sonoma counties are requiring people to separate out green waste. That's being processed into compost on a massive scale and then reapplied to vineyards and orchards and field crops almost on the scale that large farmers would do with a nitrogen fertilizer. But it's completing that loop of farm to table and table back to farm so that we're not losing nutrients and we're not losing that water-holding capacity. It can be done on all scales, and that's a great thing. If we understand the principles that can help us adapt to climate uncertainty, farmers can innovate to make it work at any scale.
It's interesting that cities, municipalities, counties are basically taking the compost from their kitchens. Even if they're living in apartment buildings and don't even have a yard or a garden or anything, that compost is going back onto the land.
Well, I want to hear something crazy. A friend of mine who's done studies in both the Santa Fe area and in Arizona where I work, Ken Meter from Crossroads Center, says that it's great that we're having all this food going to restaurants as local food now, but the thing that would help the Arizona and New Mexico economies the most is if we stop buying expensive inputs from out of state. In the five counties that I work in Arizona, that's $200 million of inputs from out of state to grow about $320 million of food each year. If we got our compost from within our urban and suburban areas, if we did forest thinning for fire reduction and put that chipped wood material in with the green waste, we could dramatically reduce the inputs to our agriculture, and farmers would come out with a better bottom line, a more positive financial status in Arizona and New Mexico than they have now, because their major cost after labor for keeping their food production going are these very expensive and carbon-rich inputs from elsewhere.
We're talking to Gary Paul Nabhan. One of the things that you have looked at and continue to look at is traditional farming practices from people who are desert farmers and who have been desert farmers for generations, if not millennia, and you've drawn from their knowledge and their wisdom, and I think wisdom is an operative word here. I mean, farming is not just science, it's also a cultural and wisdom tradition.
That's right, and I'm blessed by the fact that I come from a Lebanese and Syrian family, along with my cousin there in Santa Fe, Camille Flores, where farmers have been adapting to climate uncertainty for millennia in Lebanon and Syria, and they have so many strategies that we can learn from. I think one thing that concerns me about American sustainable agriculture advocates is that we're not looking to what indigenous and immigrant peoples who've had deep understanding of heat and drought and climate uncertainty in other parts of the world are doing. We think it's too labor intensive. It doesn't have to be. It's too place specific. That's right. There's no formula of adapting these things to other localities, but we can take their principles and innovate, if we understand those principles, to make them work here. And water harvesting is one of those things. We don't need to harvest water, rainwater, and catch it like the prehistoric Nabataeans did in Jordan and Israel, but we can harvest water, as many people around Santa Fe and Albuquerque are already doing, getting a rooftop runoff into cisterns and then storing it in the soil of their yards to produce beautiful and abundant gardens.
I think that what you're talking about, or it seems like what you're talking about, learning from ancient traditions and also, you know, using all of our modern and scientific and technological knowledge that we have and which is abundant, is something that requires, to some extent, a paradigm shift, particularly on the part of agribusiness, which seems quite set in their ways. I mean, do you see any changes in these places like California, where huge amounts of food are produced, but they're also getting these over 100 degree temperatures in the summer? Do you see any signs of change among the gigantic food producing corporations?
Well, I do, and let's unpack that a little bit. There's some kind of food, perhaps certain grains or oil seeds, that will never be done on a small farm scale. It takes a certain level of equipment and milling capacity and other things to grow them. So we need to get the best that we can out of mid-scale and large-scale agriculture, and the best out of small-scale localized agriculture, and those have different costs with them. But the point is that there's innovation going on at all levels, and I don't think it's a choice of one kind of thing over another. I want to reserve our options for the future so that we have a range of agricultural strategies, styles, and scales that can feed our populace. Primarily, the last 3 years, we've imported more food to the U.S. than we exported because of the climatic catastrophes that we've had. Over a third of the entire country declared drought disaster areas, plus Hurricane Sandy and dramatic floods in the east. And so we need to make this work for all scales of agriculture. Some agribusiness lobbying groups don't want any climate change legislation because they think this just means more regulation for farmers. I think we need to listen to what they're saying and say, we don't want to regulate you. We want to give you incentives. We want cities to pitch in with their compost. We want to lower the hurdles to using gray water and rainwater in a more effective manner rather than straddling you with regulations. We want to foster innovation, and we want to happen at all scales. We don't need to pit small-scale farmers against large-scale farmers. We need to all work together for a safer, more just, and secure food system.
Well, it's kind of ironic because as it is now, organic farmers are saddled with far more paperwork and bureaucratic regulation than pesticide-using farmers.
I agree with you. I have a whole closet full of the bags and receipts of what I bought for my own farm, so that when I go toward organic certification for my 5-acre orchard over the next 2 years, that I can demonstrate that I have all the paper receipts and bags to show that I've been using organic methods. And so we really need to lower the hurdles to getting farmers and ranchers of all sorts to begin to innovate at a much more rapid and larger scale than they have in the past. And that's what I love about some of the organizations in the Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and even Las Cruces area, from the Kavira Coalition that is looking at all the great innovations ranchers are doing, to the La Semilla Food Center in the Las Cruces, El Paso area, to the farm-to-table effort that sponsors the Southwest Marketing Network meetings once a year in Santa Fe. You really are in a hotbed of innovation in Santa Fe, and we just need to make sure that those innovations are heard about by very busy farmers and ranchers, most of them working two jobs, and that they feel it's within their capacity to take on that kind of innovation, because we are not going to farm and produce food and move food as we have over the past 75 years for the next 75 years. Agriculture and food distribution are going to be radically restructured. That's not my prediction. That's coming both from the industry and from energy and natural resource economists that say business as usual ain't going to happen. And we need to be ready for that. And rather than doing it by the stick of regulation. We need some sweet carrots to get people to use their creativity for what you properly call both the art and science of agriculture. It is a cultural act.
Well, and as you point out in your book, and I think it's very important to think about this, is that human beings are a ridiculously successful species on the Earth in the sense that we've grown to over 7 billion and all of that. But we've kind of forgotten that the Earth is a place that we share with all kinds of other species. And that's part of what you're looking at, too, is a relationship with the Earth. I mean, we use water, but fish and all kinds of other creatures also need that water. Otters, as we talked about the other day here on this show. And part of this process is about finding a more respectful and humble relationship to the land and water and the Earth itself.
That's right. And if farmers in the Las Cruces area are struggling for 1/12 of the amount of irrigation water that they had in the past, you can be sure that not many fish are going to make it south of Elephant Butte all the way down to El Paso, that in-stream flows are diminished when agricultural water uses trump environmental uses. I think we need to turn it around where we talk about the fact that we are really co-farming with other species, and that may sound a little bit woo-woo until you realize that we can't produce our food without the microbes in the soil, without pollinators. And Time magazine, 15 years after Steve Buckman and I wrote the book Forgotten Pollinators about the looming pollinator crisis, finally got it that this is a national issue, that over 200 some of the 300 major commodities in our grocery stores are at risk if honeybee, bumblebee, and other pollinators continue to decline at the rate that we can. We either make room for pollinators and soil microbes on our farms, or our yields will go down, our food security will be at risk, and the cost of food will rise out of reach of the poorest of the poor. And New Mexico and Arizona have some of the highest levels of childhood food security of any states in the country. Despite the good work of many food activists in New Mexico, it's a disgrace that so many of our kids already go to school hungry because of the rising cost of foods, the poor payment for farm workers and food service workers, and the inequities in our economic system and food system that are driving more people into hunger and obesity than ever before in American history.
We're talking to research scientist and author Gary Paul Nabhan. I don't know how the economics of this works, but it seems like there's so many people who are unemployed, and there's so much work to be done on farms, and it would be really interesting if people could be employed to do some of this, perhaps a bit more labor-intensive agriculture that would result in better and healthier and more climate change-adapted food production.
I can't agree with you more. A friend of mine, and I won't mention who he is because that's not the point, but with a couple more laborers per acre on a community-supported agriculture project, is grossing over $65,000 per acre with year-round cultivation under grow tunnels during the winter and row covers, $65,000 an acre instead of $5,000 to $8,000 an acre, just by having that attention on the land, doing multiple croppings of greens and other quick-growing vegetables. And so if we wisely use labor rather than scaring labor away from our fields as the immigration debate has done. We had 15% of New Mexico chili crops left unpicked, green chilies the last couple of years, $9 billion of fruit crops and vegetables left on the ground in fields and orchards last year for lack of labor. this seems like a colossal disaster that we have unemployed people seeking jobs and food being wasted, and we can't fix this problem. Republicans and Democrats have to come together and say, do we want farming and ranching to work in the future? And if so, who can help us do that? Are we going to be dependent on China for all our apples, or are we going to lower the hurdles to getting people who willingly want to work in agriculture into our orchards and fields to do that work and take good care of them so that they can have long, productive lives? I think this is one of the major issues that we need to solve, not only in the immigration reform, but in making our state economies work better in the Southwest.
The book is called Growing Food in a Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers on Adapting to Climate Uncertainty. And one of the things I really appreciate about the book is that it has a lot of wisdom in it. I mean, it talks about the desert not just as a place, but as a metaphor, and there are many parables and stories that have very deep roots. And it's also meant to inspire its readers toward practical action. What are some of the things that you encourage ordinary people to do who care about their food and who care about their water, but who aren't necessarily farmers or even backyard gardeners?
Well, that's a really great question. You've caught the essence of the book. This is why we all have to be engaged in this and not just leave it up to the 1.5% of Americans left who call themselves farmers. Our food system is too important to be, for its health or ill health, to be left up to government and agribusiness alone. So we need to be involved as citizens, as thinking of ourselves as redesigners of our food system. So you don't have to be a farmer's market manager, a farmer, or a chef to participate in fomenting change that will help keep our kids healthy. You can work on school lunch issues. You can work on rainwater runoff issues, like people have done, Joel Glansberg and other people in the Santa Fe area, with your arroyos running down toward the Rio Grande, and revegetate those and put edible landscaping in them. There's people working to top work trees in city parks in Arizona and California to add fruit varieties to old apple trees or ornamental plum or pear trees so that homeless people can have food out on the street, food for free that's nutritious, available in public places. So there's educators who are doing incredible things, getting kids to do school gardens on school grounds, and part of that food is then used in after-school programs to keep the kids off the streets and engaged with the land. And I think there's a niche for every one of us. You don't have to want to be a farmer or a chef to be co-designer of just and healthy and resilient food systems. We need every skill set out there, from economists to faith-based communities, making sure that the hungry are taken care of, to zoners and planners and composters and water harvesters.
Gary Paul Nabhan is Kellogg Endowed Chair for Sustainable Food Systems at the Southwest Center at the University of Arizona. He will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
And join me Saturday morning at the Santa Fe Farmers Market as well.
Excellent. Okay, see you then.
Thanks so much.